You're creature of the night, Michael. Just like out of a comic book. You're a vampire, Michael. My own brother, a goddamn shit-sucking vampire. Oh, you wait till Mom finds out, buddy.
You better get yourself a garlic t-shirt, buddy.
Now you know what we are, and now you know what you are.
Kill your brother.
You'll feel better.
Welcome back to Chronologically. This is the podcast where we go through the full filmographies of some of cinema's greatest creators. My name is Jeff, and over there, that's Eric.
Hey, Jeff, how's it going this morning?
It's going well, man. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Having a good morning. It's sunny here for once. Beautiful.
Oh, it's raining here. It's wonderful. Except that it's not. Anyway, well, what we do on this show is we go, like I said, through the full filmographies of cinema's greatest creators and all that jazz. But we are on season 4, and we've been going through the filmography of movies based on Stephen King's work. And if you tuned in last week, you heard us review a vampire movie. And over the course of that film, Eric mentioned two other movies, Fright Night and The Lost Boys, neither of which I'd seen. And apparently it was such a glaring omission that we had to watch it this week. So we're doing a bonus episode, taking a look at The Lost Boys.
I am super excited to talk about The Lost Boys. And, you know, when we were talking about Salem's Lot, I kind of drew some parallels. I might have been stretching a little bit. Like, I was talking about the scene where the brother is outside the other brother's window scratching to come in. And I think my brain got a little muddled because I had a memory from The Lost Boys of Michael floating outside Sam's window, which indeed kind of does happen in The Lost Boys, but not in the same way at all. Like, I had an image of him like kind of like popping up and floating up, you know, from below the window. And that's not it at all. In The Lost Boys, he's actually kind of a half vampire at that point, and he's not learning, like his body just starts flying and he starts floating away and he's trying to get back in the house. And his brother Sam is too freaked out and doesn't want to let him in. And so similar, but not the same. I do stand by my antlers assertion that both films
I was going to say the antlers is accurate.
Yeah, the antlers is accurate. And during the course of my research, I came across an actual Stephen King connection, kind of.
Okay.
This film was originally written by two people, and it was originally written as a Goonies-style adventure with preteens. You know, the Frog Brothers were originally 8-year-old Boy Scouts. The Sam and Michael contingent were very young.
That still kind of remains when they go down to the lair of the vampires. I definitely got Goonies vibes there. And yeah, it doesn't hurt that Corey Feldman was there as well.
Yeah, there's definitely some Goonies DNA left in this movie. But when Joel Schumacher took it from Richard Donner was originally the guy because he was fresh off of Goonies, and they were just like, here's another one, do it. And then he got distracted by Lethal Weapon. So they brought in Joel Schumacher. And Joel Schumacher was like, nah, we're gonna sexy this up. We're gonna turn this into teens. We're gonna make everybody super good looking. We're gonna go full glam MTV with this, right? And he sent the script to a guy, and it happened to be the guy who wrote The Dead Zone, the Stephen King adaptation that we're going to be watching.
All right, you're bringing it all together.
It's all coming around.
It's like the 5 degrees of bacon or however many degrees.
Exactly. Like, this really doesn't have a ton to do with Stephen King outside of the, you know, the Salem's Lot inspirations. But it is such a fun movie. I can't imagine another situation in which we would get to it. And so I don't see us doing Schumacher chronologically. No, me either. No, God, no. Batman Forever, no, thank you. So, I jumped at the chance. Like, of course I want to do this. So let's start with our usual thing. And what is your history with The Lost Boys, Jeff?
I maybe seen, I've seen several pictures of Kiefer Sutherland as a vampire, and that is about it. I never got around to it. I should have by now, being that I'm a fan of this era of movies. I specifically love genre films from the 80s, and it just, I never found the opportunity to do it.
Gotcha. Okay. I was like directly in the demographic for this film. And as part of the demographic, I didn't get to the theater to see it. I think there's this whole thing that happened where the 14 and 15 year olds who were like the perfect target audience for this movie didn't get to see it in the theater because it was rated R. But then it came out on video, and you know, everybody I knew was watching The Lost Boys like daily. I remember I rented the movie and my buddy Dean had two VCRs, and I bought a cheap VHS tape and I took it over to his house and I dubbed it, and it was the shittiest dub. It was like a really bad dub, and I watched the crap out of that thing. I must have watched it 60, 70 times. You know, this really crappy, barely, you could barely see what was going on the screen. And then like, people would come over to my house and we'd all watch my shitty dub together. Like, it was just that sort of movie. It was like, it was just the zeitgeist. It was like, I'm trying to think of other movies that were the same. Like, RoboCop was another one where, like, it was just that moment in time. And, you know, it was perfect. And it's so funny because watching this now as an adult, it's been, I still have it pretty much memorized, but it's been years since I've sat down and actually watched it. I was shocked to learn that Michael, the older brother, is actually kind of the main character of this movie.
Like, yeah.
If you would have asked me, I would have just been like, it's Corey Haim. It's Sam, 100%, because I was the same age as that kid. And that's who I identified with when I was watching this film. But he's not. He's like, you know, he's maybe a co-lead, but he's definitely not the lead. Like, it's Michael, the older brother, who's the lead character in this movie.
If you had asked me, I'd say Corey Haim was the lead, at least to me, because so much of the perspective is from his. I mean, I think it's argued that they both are co-leads. I think that's probably the more accurate thing, like you said. But I think after watching it, I would have said Corey Haim, because he gets to do all the fun stuff, right? He gets to learn about vampires and try to hunt them and becomes friends with the Frog Brothers. And Michael's distracted by his love interest and that kind of stuff. You know, I could see when you're a kid, you're more into the comic book reading, monster fighting kid than the guy who's off trying to land the lady.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Okay, so you just watched this for the very first time yesterday. Is that correct?
Yep. Yesterday, sat down and watched it.
Gut reaction. How did you like it?
It's an instant classic for me. I had recently watched for the first time War of the Roses, and I messaged you. I'm like, have you watched this? It's everything to me. It's like an instant in, I should have been watching this since I was, you know, 15. And I felt the same way watching this. I'm like, it's got all the stuff I love. You know, and like you find out who the head vampire is at the end, all the things kind of clicked in place like just beforehand. You know, I was like, oh no, Kiefer's not the main vampire. Like, even before he got killed, like, it's just something clicked in place. I'm like, it's not, it, I don't know. The adventure and the mystery of it stole me away. I guess charm, the 90s-ness of this, the hairstyles, the vampire lair is so grody and 90s edgelord that it's perfect. In some ways, it kind of reminded me of like a much messier gothic version of the Ninja Turtles lair from Ninja Turtles 2. They're in the subway. That's a weird connection, but it did. Yeah, I adored every moment of this from the start with the Thou Shall Not Fall playing over the title sequence, I was like, holy shit, it's good immediately. And then you get the sax playing man who's thrusting on stage, and I messaged you immediately. I was like, this is the movie hadn't even started, and I'm like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. A man in wrestling spandex playing the sax. He's ripped, and he's throbbing on stage, and he's the lead singer. It's the most badass thing I ever saw in my life.
Now, have you seen Sax Man, like, memes and stuff? Because he does rear his head. Like, basically, that clip that you sent me shows up online, like, once every 2 years or so. Somebody sends it out to, like, apropos to nothing. You know, like, it just kind of floats around online. Were you familiar with him before you saw this film?
No, this was my first interaction with the Sax Man, and it blew my balls off.
It's so funny because he's in the movie for literally 4 seconds, right? Like it is, I think he has 2, maybe 3 or 4 second clips in the film, you know, and it is such a cultural moment. Like, people remember this dude so much that I texted back to you. Like, he still shows up and does the thing. Like, he still takes his shirt off and does that. He has the collar and everything, and he, like, the chains around his neck. And he still, you know, plays that song and does the whole thing. And dude is still, like, really built. I saw a picture of him from maybe 5 years ago, so I can't say still.
Yeah.
But in recent times, he was still, like, in super good shape and could pull off sax man action. So, that's pretty great.
I've never seen before or since a band lead singer who also plays the sax. Right. It was such a unique, it isn't even just the costume and the thrusting. And like, if I saw a band where the lead singer was singing and then playing the sax, like, it was just badass. And then throw on that he looks like a professional wrestler, and it's amazing.
It's like Lizzo with her flute. Like, the first time I saw Lizzo pull that flute out, like, it was before she got popular, and somebody like, sent me a clip or something, and she pulls that flute out, and it's like, what, she's gonna play? And then it's like, oh my god, she's awesome with that flute. Like, she's like a virtuoso flute player. This is incredible. Same thing with sax guy. Totally. That's super. That's so great. So as far as the cast goes, were there any surprises in there for you? Like there's a lot of people in this movie.
I have to remember all of them. The first one that comes to mind is Alex Winter, because I've never seen him be anything other than Bill S. Preston from Bill and Ted.
He's wonderful, by the way. I listened to a great interview with him on Mark Maron's WTF earlier this year, I think. And he directs and produces documentaries. And he comes from this long family tradition of, like, Broadway performers and dancers and so on. And he grew up in, like, the New York theater. He's fascinating. Like, he's a really interesting dude. If you ever get a chance to, like, dig deeper on him, I totally recommend it. Yeah. But anyhow, go ahead.
Because obviously I'm a huge fan of Bill and Ted. It's one of my favorite movies. Fuck Scorsese. But I just... Sorry. I had to do it. Check our reviews if you're an Apple Podcast listener. But I just threw myself off track. What were we talking about?
Talking about the cast. So Alex Winter. And,
I'm trying to think of other cameos. Like, I knew the Coreys were in it because their name's popping up at the bottom. But the mom from Parenthood, which is what I know her from the most, she's the mom in this.
Diane Wiest. Yeah, she's excellent. She's in Life of Pieces. And also, I don't know if you've ever seen Bullets Over Broadway, the Woody Allen thing. Well worth a look just for her. Like, she's hysterical in it. She's awesome.
Associated her with Parenthood because I think she's so effective as an actress in that movie of being pained. And anyway, let's not go down the Parenthood trail. But I can't remember any other. Were there any other big surprises in here that maybe I missed? Acting wise,
I don't know about surprises, but some other people of note: Jamie Gertz is star. And you may have seen her in Less Than Zero or Twister. She's Billy's ex-wife in Twister. Oh, Billy. Max, it was so funny because I was watching it with my daughter, my 11-year-old. I deemed this rated R appropriate for my 11-year-old. I was like, I think you're good for this. And she was.
That's good, because I enjoy that she's been following this journey.
She has. So she's going to tap out on The Shining. I'm not going to let her see that. But we recently watched every season of The Gilmore Girls and the new Netflix movies. And so she is, and then she has watched all of it again, like three times. She watches it while she does the dishes. Like, she's like a super Gilmore Girls fan. And so Max is the grandpa in The Gilmore Girls. Like, he's like Mr. Gilmore, patriarch of the Gilmore family. And so the whole time I'm sitting there watching, and I'm watching her, and I'm waiting for it to click, and it's just not. Like, he looks so young in this movie, it just didn't click. And then finally I was like, do you recognize him? And she's like, no. And I was like, all right, just listen to his voice. And about halfway through the movie, about when Max is at home alone and his dog starts growling and the motorcycles are circling around outside, he has one line. She's like, oh my God, it's Richard Gilmore. Oh my God, it's Richard Gilmore. Like, yeah, good one. All right, cool. You finally got it. So that's interesting. And then one other one, and I don't know if you're familiar with the film Pumpkinhead, but it's one of my horror favorites from the 80s, starring Lance Henriksen. And the little boy who plays Laddie is also a little boy in Pumpkinhead. Completely unrecognizable, looks like 100% a different kid. I've seen both of these movies a million times, and I would have never made the connection had I not seen it online. And then, like, my brain exploded a little bit. Did not go on to continue his career much beyond, like, 1990. Just tapped out on acting. But that was exciting for me.
I'll put Pumpkinhead on my list of things to watch.
It's so good.
Yeah. I actually went and looked up Fright Night, but it wasn't free anywhere, so I was like, I'll hold off. Maybe we'll get to that eventually.
I would love to do a bonus episode on Fright Night.
Well, we have other Salem's Lots coming up, so it's not like we can't jump back in the vampire train.
Exactly. So I wanted to also talk about, again, the first time I've seen this as an adult. The film's budget, which I didn't notice when I was a kid watching this, just how kind of like small of a film it is. It just felt so big and expansive and sweeping to me when I was a kid. And then watching it this time, I'm like, oh, I'm really seeing where they're cutting some corners here, right? Like, you never see the vampires fly, you know, they go very light on the special effects and do a lot of like implying, like when the vampires attack and things, there's a lot of implication of what's going on, Jaws style, without actually showing the attacks all that much. And they save a lot of the like the blood and gore and stuff for the very end of the film. There's that one bit where they attack the people around the campfire where you get a little bit of that, but it's still very like quick flashes and so on. So I looked it up, and the film had a budget of $8 million, which is like pretty low for a film of, you know, this stature as far as, you know, classic 80s movies go. And then it ended up making $32 million at the box office, and it wasn't until it came out on video, like I said, that it was like a big hit, I think, because kids like me got to see it. But yeah, I think this movie gets so much mileage out of mood and music, you know, like it uses
the music in this movie is so good.
Yeah, it uses it so well to like set the tone and so on. I read right before we jumped on the podcast, I read that the shot, like there's this whole sequence where it's doing the Cry Little Sister song, you know, and it's going through the clouds, and then it comes down, and the camera kind of goes into the underground lair, which is the hotel that fell in the earthquake or whatever. And I read that the cloud footage they ganked from B-roll from Top Gun. Like, they took Top Gun footage and they just threw the music on top of it, and it totally works. Now you're flying with the vampires, right? Like, it 100% works. But it's interesting the way they got so much mileage out of this movie on such a low budget. When you were watching it, did it feel kind of budgety to you? Or
the only point I found, like, where I saw the seams was when Max put on his vampire face. Everyone else looked pretty good. His was a lot more like you could see the foam on his cheeks or whatever as they exaggerated his features. Everything else looked good, though, right? Like, it didn't bother me that I didn't see them flying. I thought that the effect of Michael in the bedroom as he hits the roof and it feels like there's pressure pushing him up, I thought that was great. Him going out the window, all of that felt real. Like, it didn't feel cheesy. You didn't see any strings. It felt like they pulled off a pretty good special effect that worked for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think like, by choosing what to show and what to focus on, they really pulled off. It's very effective, you know, like the scene where he has to go, where Sam has to run out and free Nanook from the, he's tied to the fence. Yeah. And the vampires are kind of like swooping down and you can feel them coming, you know, and it's all done through camera work. Like, you never see the vampires. And it's almost implied that they, I don't know, become smoke when they fly or something. I don't know. Like, I don't, it's interesting. It's interesting the way they do it. But yeah, it's really cool how they just used the perspective of the vampires to get away with not showing the vampires flying. It's very clever. Yeah, how did you feel about... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, how did you feel about Kiefer Sutherland as the bad guy?
Like, he's cool, like, with that blonde mullet.
Was he effective as a bad vampire?
Yeah, he's really great. Because not only was he bad, there were so many moments, you know, when you get a look of someone who's fully in control, who's not intimidated or scared, right? You know, like, you don't know who you're messing with when he looks at you. Like, that's what he's thinking. And he doesn't react with a lot of violence or anything else, but there's an element of danger in his eyes and his look that is really effective. I think he's superb in this. While all the other vampires are kind of goofballs, I mean, Alex Winter plays Bill. Come on, Michael. Ah, you know, like, he's like, it's just Bill again, which I'm fine with. But, you know, David, he is flat out excellent. Like, his cult nature, the way he kind of, you know, influences things, and his calm and join us, Michael. Like, everything he does has an element of danger while also being soft and
kind of calm, seductive
and measured. Yes. I think it's excellent.
Yeah, I didn't realize, but he was only 17 when they filmed this. Which is just shocking that a 17-year-old was able to pull off that gravitas, you know?
Yeah.
I love the shot where the Frog Brothers and Sam come in and they kill Marco, who's Bill, and they're chasing him out of the hotel, and they manage to pull Kiefer's hand into the light, and he comes back in and like he's hurt. And he's mad, and that one little tear comes down his face. You know, he says, tonight. Like, it's so good. It's so menacing. It's like, oh, you guys are just fucked. Like, you poked the biggest bear on the planet. Like, you are totally about to eat it. It's so good. Like, I think he's such a good menacing bad guy. The thing that you were mentioning about Max looking way more blown out than them, a few points on that I read that were interesting. One was that Max is supposed to be like way, way older than everybody else. Like he's a Dracula, you're a vampire, right? So he's had much more time to kind of vamp out and become all gnarly and so on. The other bit was they were originally going to have all of them all look distorted and swollen and crazy like that when they turn into vampires. And then last minute budget cuts, they had to like scale back on it. And so they just did kind of quick and dirty lesser vampire effects for all of them and just, you know, kind of build out their cheekbones and their brows a little bit and then threw those contacts in. And I thought that was also a great thing. Like it works so much better, you know, that they're not super movie monsters. Like they still mostly look like themselves when they turn into vampires. Except for Laddie. Laddie kind of vamps out a little more than the rest of them.
Well, yeah, there's the little boy too, had his little vamp out. So I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah, I think largely I much prefer the more subdued effects than the over. He looks stupid to me with his cleft chin and big cheeks, and he just, I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of like what we were talking about with Salem's Lot, where the Nosferatu was maybe not the choice, you know, like we prefer more human looking vampires. So I was reading Roger Ebert's review, which I do. If a movie came out while he was still alive, I go back and read what he had to say about it. And he had this one quote that I thought was interesting. It says, if you really stop to think about it, a bunch of vampire teenagers would be a terrible shame, a tragedy, a heartbreaking loss of innocence for them, let alone their victims. And that made me think both about this movie and about Interview with the Vampire, which I don't know if you're familiar with that.
The Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt. Yes.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Kirsten Dunst character in particular and what happens to her over time and how she doesn't age, but she mentally, you know, ages and she's trapped in this little girl's body, you know, for eternity. She's never going to grow up. And how that's kind of shown to be tragic. But then I also was thinking of it in terms of Salem's Lot and how just like willy-nilly they turned everybody into vampires, right? Without any regard at all. Like it was just like, if you have a pulse, we are going to turn you into a vampire, you know, started with kids just immediately right out of the gate, boom, boom, kids. And then send those kids to eat their own families. Right. And in the book, there's a baby vampire. Like, what do you even do with a baby? Like, do you hold it up to somebody's neck? Like, what do you do with a baby vampire? I don't know. It's just an interesting thought train to go through. Like what happens if you have an 8-year-old who's a vampire? Like what would become of Laddie, the little boy vampire, if nobody else was around? Right.
Yeah.
Like, I guess, have you ever seen Let the Right One In?
No. Is that, I've seen wasn't there a remake of,
yeah, with that, Grace Kelly,
Chloe Grace, Grace Moretz.
Chloe Grace.
I think I've seen that one.
It's an interesting one. It's about a lot of the same things. Like what happens to a little kid vampire if they never get older, right? And like the kind of established lifestyle, they basically need a Renfield caretaker to take care of them because they're, you know, too little to manage on their own. I don't know. It's interesting.
Probably more that they wouldn't be taken seriously, right? They can't go get a driver's license. You know, like, hi, I'm here to take my, I'm 68. Yeah, right, bud. Get out of here.
Well, exactly. But there's other, like, there's, other practical things. Like, where are you going to sleep? You know, like, after a certain point, your whole family's going to die regardless. You know, you're 200 years old. How are you going to get an apartment? You know, how are you going to do anything? Basic needs need to be met whether you're a vampire or not. You know, you still need shelter. How are you going to manage that when you look like you're 7? I don't know.
Yeah.
Interesting things. So where are you at on the Corys?
Oh, I love the Corys. Me personally, I love the Corys, especially I'm more of a Feldman than a Haim kid. Mostly, maybe that's just because of saturation, because Corey Feldman has been in, at least it feels to me like he's been in a lot more things. But there's something that's always appealing about Corey Feldman when he's in something. Like I said, I think on another episode, he's the voice of Donatello to me. And for Haim, I'm always surprised how much I like him on screen. Especially like this younger one, he's very charismatic. His little smile, his cheeky smile that he does, especially when he meets the Frog Brothers. I like these two kids. They seem kind of dangerous to me. Like, I wouldn't fuck with these kids. And yet he does not care. He's just so nonchalant. You know, he shows up, I don't record comics, and he's just really charismatic and cool. Like, if I was his age, I would think he was like the coolest kid. So we're going to see another Corey Haim, Stephen King movie here in a bit with Silver Bullet. And which I've seen, and I like him in that. So I like both the Corys. I mentioned, oh, we got both the Corys in this one. I kind of Googled what other movies have both the Corys, but like License to Drive, this one that I've seen many times. But I'm a fan. I would say I'm a fan of both Corys.
I'm so glad you said that, because I am also a fan of both Corys. And Corey Haim, you know, obviously a tragic figure, you know, and both these guys were already struggling by the time they made this movie, right? Like, Corey Feldman almost got booted off the movie for showing up coked out, and they let him come back and finish when he promised to pull it together, which he did. But yeah, I also think that Corey Haim is such a charismatic performer, and this movie is like this kid at the height. Like, he's 14 years old and he's at the height of his powers charismatically. He's so funny. The way he reacts to his brother once his brother starts becoming a vampire and he realizes what's going on, like all the little
My
faces
favorite
he
line.
Makes when he's
a real shit sucking vampire. Just loved it.
It's so good. He's just such a natural, right? And you can really see why the two of them got paired together, because they do have this chemistry together. And I also Googled films with them together, and really, like, there's not that many before it goes to shit. Like, we think of the two Corys as like this long-term pairing, cinematic classic Abbott and Costello group. There's only really 3 movies before it goes to shit, right? There's The Lost Boys, there's License to Drive, which I agree with you is a lot of fun. I watched that one a lot as a kid too, not as much as this one, but I watched it a lot. And then Dream a Little Dream is next, and it already is getting a little weird, right? Like, that movie mm-hmm. is a weird ass movie. From there we go into Blown Away, which is an erotic thriller with Corey Haim and Nicole Eggert as the two leads. And then beyond that, straight to video. National Lampoon's Last Resort. Listen, just because it's so weird, I grabbed the synopsis of this one. Sam and Dave, after being fired from a fast food outlet and getting evicted, are magically transported to Sam's uncle's island. They are asked to help save the island. The band Dread Zeppelin perform the film's theme song as the credits roll at the end. That's the Wikipedia entry for that movie. You got Dream a Little Dream 2, and then Busted, which is Corey Feldman's directorial debut. Listen to this one. The police force of the somewhat quiet town of Amity decide to get crime off the streets and decide that the prostitutes are better off working out of the police station. The ladies take over several police duties to ensure their cover. And then another bit, which is less fun, is it's a 1997 comedy film. It marked Corey Feldman's directorial debut. Due to his frequent absences and drug use, Corey Haim was eventually fired by Corey Feldman. Feldman later said that it was one of the hardest and most painful things he ever did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then, you know, some TV appearances, and then, of course, they made that television show. There was a reality show with the two of them together, which was supposed to be kind of like a fun romp, odd couple sort of situation, but it very quickly got serious, you know, and turned out to be like a documentation of Corey Haim not being able to pull his shit together. And it was right around the time they were prepping to film The Lost Boys 2. And there's an episode of that show where Corey Feldman tells Corey Haim that he's not going to be able to be in the movie because he doesn't have his shit together, which is just a sad ending to the whole thing. You know, like, it is a bummer.
I didn't realize that Corey Haim died in 2010. I, for some reason, thought he died a lot longer ago.
No, yeah, he was around for a while. And I remember
Mandela effect or something.
Yeah, I remember seeing like a 60 minute segment or 2020 or something like that about him when he was really trying to make a comeback. Like he had been sober for a while and he was really trying to like get back into films. He was in Jason Statham's film Crank 2, I think he's in. And that he didn't die of an overdose. He died of pneumonia complications.
Yeah.
And, you know, the implication was that his body was just wrecked by years of, you know, drug abuse and so on. But yeah, he did not OD. Anyhow, that's enough of the sadness of the Coreys. There's no doubt that in those first few movies, though, they are fantastic. And some of Corey Haim's other early performances are also really good. I love Lucas. I don't know if you've ever seen that one with Charlie Sheen and Winona Ryder and Cary Grant. That's a really good movie.
What? No, I'm thinking of Lucas is, I might be conflating two movies. He's a little boy in that, and I can't remember. I think I've seen it. It sounds really familiar.
He's a little kid with glasses and he's kind of weird and he wants to play football. And, he falls in love with Cary Grant, who's from the Goonies, and she's a little older than him. And
okay, I have seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. It's a really cool film. It was before this one. But yeah, so anyhow, no doubt that I would say this movie is probably the best movie that they were in together.
Of the Coreys, I'd have to agree, not having seen a lot of them, but really, and I haven't seen License to Drive in decades, but yeah, probably. This would be a tough one to top anyway.
Yeah. So that's kind of all I had for The Lost Boys.
Let's talk about the Frog Brothers real quick, though. I love the Frog Brothers, mostly because there's a couple things that happen. Like, first off, I didn't realize it till later they introduced themselves. I'm Alan, or I'm Edgar, and this is Alan, which I don't think is an accident. Edgar Allan, and you'd think their names would be Poe, but
they're Frog.
But the fact is, I feel like they're bullshitting, right? In the comic book store when they're talking about, like, obviously they know there's vampires, and I believe them, but they talk about killing them. Right. Oh, I'll kill them. It's no big deal. And you feel like they're bullshitting, right? Like, they aren't these tough guys. They're just teenage little punks who talk big shit. And then they go and they do the killing and they're as adept. Like when Corey Feldman drives the stake through Bill's heart and it just goes right in like butter. I'm just like, these guys are the real deal, right? They're the real deal. Like, they are here to fuck shit up. And then when he goes, there's the scene when the attack starts happening, and I think Corey's like, fuck it, I'm just going to kill the half vampires that we got here. And he chases the girl with the stake. I just love them because they have subverted all my expectations. I thought when the shit hit the fan, they were going to run and leave, but nope. We're here to kill vampires. We're vampire hunters, and we're 14. Love them.
It's It's funny because like you do think they're bullshitting. I don't know if they've ever actually killed a vampire before or not, right? Like, they're definitely serious about doing it, and they're committed, and they're going to stay and get the job done. Is Bill the first vampire they've ever killed? Maybe, you know, because like he screams, they scream, everybody's screaming, the blood is flying everywhere, you know, they're freaking out. And it's funny, like there's this like joyful enthusiasm they have later on in the movie about killing the vampire when the dog pushes them into the bathtub and they're like, oh, we annihilated him. Like, did you, you know, it's funny, but I mean, yeah, you can tell
they got the like, holy this, water this right. They got the garlic. They just followed the vampire rules and it worked.
Yeah, they definitely, I would say, know what they're doing, but this might be them, you know, like popping their vampire killing cherry. Like this could be the first
I
one.
Agree.
And it is funny the way how they just like pivot. You know, like, we're going to kill your brother. Like, no, don't kill your brother.
We'll take care of
okay, we're not going to kill your brother. It's funny how they
it reminded
so
me
easily...
of the backup that in E.T. that Elliot had, you know, like, or Elliot's brother had. It was just kind of the same charm. They roll up on their bikes and they get off of them and they're walking to the door and their bikes are still falling over. Like, that's how fast they got off their bikes. And it's just like, there's something about the crew rolling together that was just so appealing and fun.
Oh yeah, the scene where they're testing Max to see if he's the head vampire, it's one of the best scenes in the movie. Like it's maybe not as memorable as some of the other ones, but it's low key hilarious when they're like trying all the different stuff on Max and the mom is just bewildered and has no idea what's going on. They're feeding him garlic and squirting him with the water and sticking him in front of the mirror. I don't know. I thought that was pretty good. It does. This movie has slightly different rules about inviting the vampire into your house, right?
Like, yeah.
It's not that the vampire can't come in, because at the end, they all come in. You know, like, they are not invited, and they absolutely are coming in. It's that if you invite them in, none of your vampire tricks will work on them, right? Which reminds me, we didn't mention it in Salem's Lot, but that broke the shit out of its own rules at the end, because head vampire dude straight up comes into the house when he smashes the two parents together. Nobody asked his ass to come in, and he just comes barging in.
I don't think the movie established that rule, and so I was okay with it. Right, I was like, okay, that's an omission of one of the rules. Like, as long
there's
as the
a
movie
lot of
doesn't
let me in, like. All those chumps at the mirror or the windows were totally like, let me in, you know, and
you're
then
right.
He just comes rolling in. Toby Hooper, who we also didn't talk about last week. do better, Toby Hooper. God damn it. So, I think
that's all I have.
Okay, cool. So I'm so glad that you enjoyed The Lost Boys. I'm so glad that you got to see it. I don't know, like, would you have ever watched it if we hadn't have done this? Like, is it anything you would have eventually?
I think eventually, it would just, in the right situation, like if I'm scrolling through something and it's available to stream, and I would put this on. Like, this isn't outside of my wheelhouse. Like, I could have seen myself finally getting to this eventually, because it is my sort of shit. But there's a lot of stuff that I haven't got to, like Fright Night and a lot of stuff I haven't gotten to yet. So I don't know when I would have. It's possible I might not have gotten to it, but it's also the sort of thing I probably would have gotten to at some point. But I'm glad I got to watch it and talk about it with you. And it was one of the movies where I was like, I should watch it again, because you bought the Blu-ray and then sent me the digital code. So I own this forever. I can watch it whenever I want now. And I was sitting there, and it has the picture on YouTube where I watched it of them hanging off the bridge. And I was like, I want to watch it again. Like, it just was immediately like, I just want to watch this again, because it's so rich with charm and 90s, and angst. It's just a gem, like a you press something down and it gets all compact, and all that's left is the good stuff. That's what this is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the music too. I highly recommend the soundtrack, which was in heavy rotation also during that period of my life. We listened to this soundtrack a lot. That Echo and the Bunnymen cover of People Is Strange by The Doors is really mm-hmm. great. Oh, I forgot to mention this. Total aside, but this is the first time I ever noticed the shot where they have Michael and he's in front of that giant poster of Jim Morrison on the wall, and how yeah. much they kind of like superimpose him over it, and how much he kind of looks like that. I don't know if it was just coincidence, if they're like, God, they kind of look the same, let's do this thing, or if that was all planned out or what, but it is a really cool shot. Like it's really neat when they do it. So that's just a total
aside. I like that the vampires have taste in music, you know, like,
right.
They like the Doors.
Huge Doors fans. All right. Huge Doors fans. All right. So let's wrap it up. What are we doing out next? Of here.
The next, as I said last week, we're watching The Shining next. I'm not going to go through the whole spiel again. You know about The Shining. It's Kubrick. It's a classic. So we're going to watch that next. I'm going to hold off. I'm really looking forward to talking about it. And that's all I'll say right now, because I'm tempted to talk about how I feel about it currently. But looking to see if maybe things have changed, my opinion. So you can tune in to hear that next week. Also, if you want to get in touch with Eric, you can find him on Twitter at Eric_Hotter. You can find me on Twitter at Podcast by Jeff. You can also check out my other podcast called The Movie Draft House. If you want video game reviews, check out Eric's reviews over at GamingNexus.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Chronologically Pod. I think that's it.
That is it. Yeah.
We'll see you next
Excellent.
Week.
Bye, all. Thanks.